NYPL Podcasting. Remembering Uta Hagen was recorded live at the Library for the Performing Arts on September 18th, 2008. Please be aware that there are audio problems for the first 10 minutes of this podcast.
Good evening. Thank you for coming. My name is Alan Cowley, and I'm producer of the Performing Arts Library's public programs. I welcome you to the opening of our 2008-2009 season, and to our first program in a series celebrating a major bequest to the Billy Groves Theater Division. The Uta Hagen Herbert Berghoff papers contain correspondence, personal and family papers, datebooks, diaries, production and publicity materials, scripts, prompt scripts, manuscripts, programs, photographs, slides, scrapbooks, posters, clippings, and oversized materials documenting the professional and personal lives of Uta Hagen and Herbert Berghoff. The joy of working on this series lies not only in the resulting program, which will be taped and which will further enrich our collections, but also in meeting and working with some extraordinary people from HB. First and foremost, Jesse Filer, and also Richard Maugh and Rochelle Oliver. I want to say a special thank you to Letty Ferrer, who is daughter. One lesson you learn when you've worked for the library as long as I have is where to go for accurate information. So I hope Letty won't mind that we will continue to turn to her. The New York Public Library and the HB Studio have much in common. The mission statement of the HB Studio includes the line, "We provide a haven for working professionals free from commercial pressures." The staff of the library takes particular pleasure in welcoming the representatives of the studio here tonight. So thank you for coming. I had the great joy to work with Kim Hunter on several occasions. Kim was, of course, the original Stella in A Streetcar Named Desire. She won her Tony working with Jessica Tandy and her Oscar working with Vivian Leigh. I once asked Kim, who was the best Blanche? She replied, "Uta." Here's an excerpt from a letter which will be read in full by Lila Robbins on Monday's program on this stage. It's to Uta from the actress Alyssa Landy, and it refers to Uta's performance as Blanche. "Your acting has left me thoughtful. What a sensitized human being you must be. How close to the surface must be your compassions, and how you must have reflected upon the most fleeting impressions. How indelible must be even the slightest experience, how inexorably you must bring to the mind the faintest tremors of the heart. Thank you for the beauty." Foster Hirsch, teacher, author, lecturer, is one of the thousands of generous people who donate their time to make the library's public programs possible. On this stage, he has interviewed Nanette Fabre, Anthony Harvey, Kim Carlisle Hart, Joe Sullivan Lesser, and many others. Please welcome Foster Hirsch.
We're here today to remember a remarkable woman who was a great teacher, a great writer, a great performer, a great friend. She was an exemplary theater professional. She made her debut as Ophelia opposite Eva Galeen's Hamlet, and her Broadway debut in 1938 in the Luntz production of The Seagull. So she really started at the top, didn't she? Her credits after that were equally stellar. She was in Maxwell Anderson's Key Largo opposite Paul Newman, in Othello opposite Paul Robeson and her then husband, Jose Ferrer, in A Streetcar Named Desire, in which she played opposite four Stanleys, Marlon Brando, Jack Palance, Ralph Meeker, and Anthony Quinn. Her favorite, and she was very frank about it as everything else, was Anthony Quinn. In The Country Girl, she won her first Tony Award. She appeared in St. Joan, and then, of course, her signature role as Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, for which she received her second Tony Award. She was in The Cherry Orchard, directed by Eva Galeon, Mrs. Klein, Charlotte, and in two plays by her very favorite playwright, George Bernard Shaw, Mrs. Warren's Profession, and You Never Can Tell. I'm actually very happy to say that in addition to those great performances in great plays, Uta Hagen was human, and she was in plays that weren't any good, and that everybody has forgotten, except for people like me, who's a theater historian and supposed to know everything. Now, does anybody here remember Uta Hagen in Vicky? No. In Island of Goats? No. In The Magic and the Loss, which to me is a perfect title for a Broadway flop. And in a play no one remembers called The Whole World Over, which in fact was very significant for Uta Hagen herself because she was directed by Harold Corman, who opened her eyes to acting and characterization and directing in an extraordinary way that she never forgot. And it was on that show that she met her husband-to-be, Herbert Berghoff. So we must mark that forgettable play, The Whole World Over. Remember that and The Magic and the Loss. Don't forget those titles. She made only three movies, unfortunately. The Other, Reversal of Fortune, and The Boys from Brazil. And in true Hollywood fashion, she always acted in those films with a German accent. They only saw her, I suppose because of her name, as German. She spoke totally unaccented English, of course. She was on TV infrequently, and she showed the same extraordinary taste and judgment as in the theater. There were no love boats and no murder she wrote. For over 5 decades, she taught acting at the HP studio. I mean, an extraordinary record. How many students of hers are here tonight? We will talk about her legacy as a teacher. I'll be joined on the stage by 4 distinguished colleagues and friends. But before we get started, I want to read a very brief excerpt from her book, A Challenge for the Actor, which really expresses her principles of living and teaching and being. Only by setting an example, by functioning at our best, can we be of influence in making the theater a better place. The struggle to attain perfection is what matters. It includes maintaining innocence as opposed to cynicism, curiosity as opposed to smugness, a willingness to question and to search for new answers, the readiness to take risks, and the daring to fail. And if enough of us really mean it, we can join in a communal effort to make acting truly a noble profession. That is how she lived her life, and that is what we're here to celebrate today. As a moderator, I'm going to be extremely well organized, so I've divided the program into 4 parts. With part 1, we're going to talk about Uta Hagen as a teacher. In part 2, we're going to talk about Uta Hagen from the point of view of actors who work with her. Part 3 is Uta Hagen on stage from the perspective of the audience, you and me. Part 4, reminiscences about Uta Hagen off stage, what was she really like in her private life. So at the end of the program, I think we'll have a very good idea of the legacy of this extraordinary woman. We begin part 1 with reminiscences from 2 of her students in some of her earliest classes. Both students went on to have distinguished careers of their own. First, I think she may be one of the earliest surviving Uta Hagen students in his first or second class. Barbara Barry, you all know her. She is, of course, I forget the in the original company. She was in Prisoner, Second Avenue, California Suite, Torchstone's trilogy, and many films and TV roles, including one film that is really good and that I haven't seen in a long, long time, a landmark film called One Potato, Two Potato, which is awesome. And she was nominated for an Academy Award for Breaking Away. Joined in talking about Uta Hagen as a teacher by Fritz Weaver, whose many credits include The Chalk Garden, The Great God Brown, A Shot in the Dark, The White House, The Fellow Gaze, Child's Play, for which he won the Tony Award, Baker Street, The Crucible, Ring around the Moon, many films and TV credits, including Marathon Man, Fail Safe, and on television, Holocaust. Fritz Lieber.
Okay, we're going to start with your reminiscences of the kind of teacher that Uta Hagen was. I actually sat in on some of her classes. Her classroom was open to anybody who was interested. And I think you paid $2 or $3 at the time, and you got to hear Uta Hagen teach. And what I was impressed by was that she was a woman of very few words. Was that true in the early days? Each word counted. Every single word counted. But there weren't a lot of them. Was that true? Was that refined for later in her life?
Where did you hear that?
I saw it. I saw it. I didn't hear it. I was the first person. I was there.
Maybe I don't remember it correctly, but it was a barrage all the time.
All the time?
Yeah, she would say things like, that was just terrible, terrible. She never, I mean, she was very verbal, very vocal.
I saw her after she'd been teaching for 40 years.
Oh, well, you weren't there in the early days.
Yeah. She'd refined it down to basics by then.
I certainly don't remember few words, but I remember definite words. You could put her in a lion's den, and she could talk to the lion. And overawe the lion. She could do it because she was definite. She made up her mind rather quickly about everything, and she became your friend for life, or not. The doors clanged shut on some people, and I think you and I were pretty lucky, because we stayed pals with her for all of her life.
Yeah, we really were lucky.
What were her specific points as a teacher? What was she looking for
say something truly emotional. She changed my life, and I think she changed the lives of most actors who worked with her, because I'm not sure what she was looking to make you good. You know, she was looking to give you a craft, an answer to your question. But I have to tell you, the first time you had to audition for her class, and we went up these 5 flights on 23rd Street to this room where there was a gas heater. That's when she first started teaching. And we had a very interesting class. We had Ann Mira, Jerry Stiller. We had Charles Nelson Reilly. We had me. We had a wonderful girl named Olga Bellin. Another really brilliant actress named Zora Lampert, who really was, I think, the best actress of our generation. Somebody clapped out there. That's right, right? Anyway, so we were all there, and we were all working by that time. There was nobody in that room who wasn't working. She looked at us all, and she said, I guess you think you all are you auditioned, you got into my class, and you're all working, you're earning a living, and not one of you knows how to act. That's how we started.
That's how you started.
Yeah. So anyway, I think what she tried to do is to give us a craft, to give us a way of working, which we all evidently needed to do, because we were pretty slick, I think. You know, we were slick.
She stripped away what she brought, and in my case, it certainly, I brought in a million bad habits that I picked up in summer stock and then at the university, and she stripped all that away. And the first thing she said, we went in and she said, what are you going to do for your audition? And you said, I want to do the Heath scene from King Lear. She said, you will do nothing of the sort. we all came in. I was of a generation, even before Barbara, that worshipped. They had all kinds of bad habits from the previous theatrical generation. John Barrymore, Orson Welles. I know she's in the house, Letitia Letty Ferrer, but Jose Ferrer was also part of a tradition that had a classical kind of acting. She put all that behind her. The early part of her life, however, she was just the way all of us were. She knew how to make a fantastic entrance and a great exit, and she had all kinds of bad habits, and she despised that in herself. And by the time I came onto the scene, she had shed all that, and she was determined that we were going to shed all that, too. But I was terrible. I flung my arms around, and I looked at this, and I did all kinds of crazy things. And she just simplified and was always wanted your truth. That's why we weren't allowed to do King Lear. First thing she gave me was The Petrified Forest of a very shy young man. And I somehow brought it off. I don't know how I did. And she liked it. And I felt that I was her friend. And then she said, are you going to finish that beer that you used in the scene? I said, no, I'm not. She said, may I have it, please? And drank it.
Now, in later years, again, this may be the difference between Uta Hagen at the beginning and when I saw her 40 years later. If you walked down Bank Street before an Uta Hagen class, you saw students weighed down with props.
Yes, right.
Props and props. They practically, tons of them. Was she asking for props in those days, objects that you had to relate to?
Oh, yeah, that was part of her teaching, that you had to be surrounded with your life. And you had to have objects, every one of which you related to. This is a glass that my wife gave me. She subsequently left me, so when I'm drinking this, I'm thinking about her. I mean, she was very specific, and each object had to have a personal significance to you.
What about costumes?
Not so much then. But you had to dress appropriately. You can't come in blue jeans and play, Eugene O'Neill or something. You had to dress appropriately, but she didn't worry about that. I don't recall, did she?
No, I don't think so.
No, she...
That prop thing, she had an exercise where you took three objects, it could be any three objects you wanted, and you created a two-minute scene around the objects. And what came out of that was really fantastic. I mean, you found things in yourself that you didn't know were there because you did it at home. You know, you really did homework at home, and then you brought it in. And sometimes it would be such an emotional revelation. I remember I did one thing that was too boring to go into, but one of the things was it ended up by my pretending that I was on Edward R. Murrow and he was visiting my house. And I was on television. And what happened when Edward R. Murrow interviewed me was that I burst into tears. I mean, that kind of revelation is what she hoped would come to you through the use of objects. Because if you're using the objects, you're not thinking about the result, mm-hmm. about what you are feeling. And she used to say, do the action and the emotion will come. She always said that, remember?
Yes.
Don't try to get it. It'll just...
Don't feel.
Don't
do.
Right. Do. Acting is doing. She used to say, acting is doing.
I remember often in the classes I witnessed, she talked about prior circumstances, that the actor must know what happened to the character before entering the stage.
Immediately before.
Immediately before. So you're coming on from somewhere.
Yeah. You've dropped your keys, and you can't find them, and the door opens, and you're still looking for your keys, and you come on. And it takes that blinding awareness of being in front of an audience away from you, because you're already in motion, you're already in action. And she stressed that a lot.
She did. What is happening to you the moment before you open the door? It's an incredible thing to have as an actor. Right, Marion? Isn't it? It's incredible.
Did she also do sense memory, sensory memory, heat and cold and headache? And there's a lot in her books about that, and I remember in her later classes.
Well,
she
made a distinction between sense memory and emotion memory. And sense memory was just what you say, heat, cold, and so forth. You got to be very familiar with states of the surrounding atmosphere. Emotion memory was something quite different. It was something that you experienced a long time ago, and there were ways in which you could encounter that, you could trigger those emotions if you could remember sufficiently well the place in which the experience happened, if you could remember the necktie of the person who was talking to you or the color of the mosaic in the fireplace or something. And usually it's those little things that would bring on the memory, and I found that very difficult, and but so valuable. I've used that a thousand times. And she would say, you have to search for triggers for almost everything. And you have a whole armory of them after a while, and you
but
use them.
She wouldn't want to know the triggers. She wouldn't invade
no,
her personal life
rather
at all.
Not
that's,
know.
That's for the actor himself or herself.
Personal.
You know what her triggers were, some of them? She confessed to us or confided in us. Her triggers, a lot, had to do with her father.
Mm.
Growing up with her father in Wisconsin, right? In Madison, Wisconsin. And she used to talk about her father a lot, and she would say she could just remember things, colors or drapes or something about him, and it, whatever she needed would be available to her.
But you don't share that with anybody.
Not unless you're in deep trouble, you know.
Yeah. But she never overstepped her bounds as a teacher. She never presented herself as an analyst who could help students with their personal problems.
No. Do you think?
Oh, no. But she had a powerful analytical mind. She could put her finger right on... what a combination. Emotionally, she was a volcano. But a mind that could go into the most... had studied herself so deeply. The books are so full of, dense with detail about all that is you have to contact in when you're dealing with a script, and a brand new script to the character, and all that you had to find in yourself that would make it possible for you to do the plays. But she was an amazing combination of this, a brilliant analytical mind and an emotional genius.
Did she focused a lot on inner work. Did she ever talk to you about voice and projection, or was that for a professional situation?
She once said to me, "You have a nice voice."
Sort of, right?
I don't ever want to hear you using it. And then she quoted Joseph Jefferson, the American actor. He said, "A good voice has ruined more actors than whiskey." So she knew that the voice was there to convey the subtlest kind of nuance of what's going on in you. And if you ever are reminded that somebody is using the instrument for its own sake, she had no use for that. The same way if you were a very beautiful person and you were using that, she would have no use for that.
When I saw her, she was a wonderful audience. She would laugh at students, and the laughter was so rich. And I felt she was helping the student along. She was supporting the student.
Oh,
was that there then?
And she would often speak right in the scene. You were talking and saying, "I love you," and said, "That's good, Fritz, keep going." It never threw me either. She knew how to move in. Herbert did this also. Herbert could talk you through a scene.
See, the thing is, you had an idea. I was just graduated college. I was a little girl from Texas, is what I was, and I met this bigger than life person. And you had this feeling, and you knew that she was bigger than life, and that. Mm-hmm. I get teary when I think about it. And she could give you bigger lessons about acting and certainly about life than you would ever even expect it to encounter. I mean, as you say, she was a volcano. And you know, she used to smoke in class. Hmm. We couldn't smoke, but she could smoke. And she would sit over there puffing away. But so with you, right? So it was... as I say, she changed my life, and I think she changed the lives of everybody in that class.
Part two is we're going to talk about actors who've worked with Uta Hagen on stage, and I'd like for Richard Easton to join us. I'm going to tell you a little about Richard Easton. His credits indicate that he has as much taste as Uta Hagen had. His credits include The Country Wife, The School for Scandal, The Misanthrope, Noises Off, Henry IV, Lincoln Center, 2004, The Rivals, recently, The Coast of Utopia. And even when he was on in TV and in films, the taste was impeccable, and he's here to join us to talk about working with Uta Hagen. Richard Easton.
What a woman.
Oh. Now, Richard Easton has the distinction, which I'm fascinated to hear about, of working with Uta Hagen in the London production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, in which you played Nick.
Yes.
What was that like?
Oh, that was wonderful, of course. The thing about Uta with me was I was foreign. I was from Montreal, and I'd learned, I started acting when I was a child, really, basically, in a day when there were no teachers, of course. So one never had acting classes. When I took fencing lessons to learn how to do that, and elocution lessons, actually wandering around with a book on the head saying, how now, brown cow, literally, all that. But I never had any acting lessons as such. And even, I was very lucky, I went to England when I was young, and I worked with John Gielgud, who was a very great actor, but there was no question of any acting lessons from him. But they were in the full of advice, like, if when somebody else is talking, you look at them. When you are talking, you look at the audience. when you're talking about the moon, don't put it up there. Put it up there. Hide towards the audience. Backstage foot back, downstage foot back, so that you're slightly angled. All that sort of thing. So when I met Uta, who was obviously a very great actor too, and a great teacher, I thought there was going to be some teaching done, and there was, of course, but not in the terms that they're talking about. I played the boy in a television production of A Month in the Country, in which we rehearsed, and it was all in the days of tape, so you couldn't edit and all that. So it came time to do the dress rehearsal in the studio. And she suddenly was, very untypically, because she was always absolutely there, suddenly was saying, I think this chair, is this in the right place? And all this was going on. And I said to her, are you all right? What's wrong? She said, I know you. You're going to give your full performance at this dress rehearsal. And then when it comes time for the performance, you're going to try and copy it. And I'm not going to let you do that. I thought, that was really good. And then always, but we never talked about, we talked about acting a lot, but never in terms of teaching. And she was always full of the things like, you know, arrive at the theater empty, find the play on the stage. You know, and she would do that. She would come on empty, which is why she didn't tire, apart from that she was incredibly energetic. But also she said, what are you worried about? You only have to prepare the first moment of stepping on the stage, and the rest of it will happen, actually. And she was always, of course, she was not spontaneous in that sense. It was always exactly the same. She was like Ralph Richardson in that. Absolutely, exactly the same every night.
But you say it was the same, but it was not canned.
Never,
it wasn't automatic.
Never.
It was alive and immediate.
Because she only prepared one moment, the entrance. And after that, it had been rehearsed, of course, and all that. But it was, she was glorious. And she hated London. We did the, I was living in England then, and I came to New York to rehearse with she and Arthur Hill, and we went down and did the play. They could only do it in those days for 3 months, so they had to leave in 3 months, and she couldn't wait because she hated it all so much. And so I used to have to entertain her a lot. And so we went, there was a wonderful club called the White Elephant, which was in Mayfair, and was very grand and very, very expensive. We used to go there nightly, and we found a wonderful wine we liked very much, which was called Chambertin Clos de Baize. Who knows? But it was delicious. And she liked it a lot. And we discussed this a lot. And then many years later, when I did Exit the King on, at the Lyceum, she sent me for the opening night a magnum of Chambertin Claude Debay's. She remembered.
When you were working with Alan Schneider on Virginia Woolf in London, were there any problems? I know.
Well, you see, I mean, she existed in different periods of the theater. I mean, I was part of the time when the directors really weren't there. I mean, directors were a very good stage manager who put it in the actors. Made sure that they were heard, and you didn't discuss what you were going to do. It was the playwright had written the play, and you spoke the lines and did it. And she had no problem with that, but except that Alan was a wonderful director in that he also just talked about his own stuff, and he didn't really interfere, certainly with me and certainly not with her.
But did she never tried to direct. She remained an
actor.
No,
she was an actor.
Yeah.
I mean, totally actor.
When you worked on The Cherry Orchard, directed by Eva LaGallia.
Well, that was incredible, because she wasn't very good in The Cherry Orchard. It wasn't a good part for her. And she was having a terrible time, because she said, oh, God. I wasn't in it originally. Ellis Rabb was playing Trofimov. And they were all having a terrible time with Eva, because they said, she keeps giving line readings, what are we going to do? And I can't play it like her. And I said, well, tell her. And she said, no, I can't possibly. She gave me my first chance. She was my goddess at the time. And she was, I can't argue with her. It's too. And I said, well, this is ridiculous. Anyway, so I said, well, nothing to do with me. And then Ellis finally decided that he couldn't bear it, you know, so he quit. So I took over, and I came in very briefly. And, of course, I had about a week to get ready. So Eva was saying, would you like to... would that do? Is this good? You know, would you like this? And I said to Uta, I said, what's the problem? She's the easiest enemy. Of course she is with you, because they're in a hurry to get you right. And, oh, it was wonderful.
Now Fritz Weaver worked with Uta a lot at the HB studio, many, yes. many times. Yeah. What was she like to work with on stage
as a co-actor? I remember once in the wings, she said to me in a sotto voce, she said, I'm so glad my students aren't here tonight. which endeared her to me, because she was human. She had the same problems as an actor on the stage that all the rest of us had. And the longer she stayed at it, though, there you could see the graph rising slowly. She always said, I'm always better at the end of a run than I am at the beginning.
And she liked long runs.
She loved long runs. And she said, I saw her late in the run of, what was it? And I thought, she's just staggeringly good. And everybody else around her had turned stale and were acting by rote. And but in the middle of this was an incandescent personality. And
I think that liking of long runs helped her in that long run as a teacher.
Yeah.
She never got bored. I saw her near the end, and she was anything but bored.
Oh,
she
absolutely.
Was so enlivened.
But she always said that she hated the title Respect for Acting, which I never quite understood, because I thought it was a perfect title of that wonderful book. And exactly what she had. And the wonderful things that she kept saying, don't tell! It's a secret. Have secrets. Don't, if you're going to make a transfer, make it, but don't tell us what it is.
Barbara, you appeared with her in a reading of Shaw.
Yes, and I can't even remember what it was, but I do remember she got me. That was my first kind of important job, and she said, I want you to do this with me. I think it was at the New School. It was a Shaw, and Sandy Meisner was in it. I remember that because I thought, I'm acting on stage with Sandy Meisner and Uta Hagen. I could hardly open my mouth. I mean, I was really frightened, but she was so wonderful. She guided me through it. She made me feel as if I really were a respected actor, and I had just begun to act. And she was a mentor, I think, to a lot of people. Lots of, hire this person. And it was my first job, and yes, it was thrilling, but you can imagine how scared I was. But I just have to tell you one thing. You haven't asked me, but I'm going to tell you anyway. She said to me one day in class, I want you to do Chekhov. I want you to do the Masha. And I said, I can't do Chekhov. She said, yes, you can. I want you to do it. And I want you to, and I rehearsed it with somebody. I can't remember who. You know, we rehearsed in everybody's apartments, and we rode the subways, and we rehearsed, and we did, and we worked on it. We came in, we did the scene, and there was a long pause. And she said, you're right. You cannot do Chekhov. I was simply terrible, and I've never done Chekhov. Oh. Not because of Uta. It's not my thing, I think. But
you know. No, it's never too late.
There's that nurse in the Three Sisters.
We're going to talk now about Uta from the perspective of the audience, and joining us is a fan of Uta's who's going to share some memorable experiences of seeing her in from the house. I don't need to introduce this guest, but I will anyway. He is simply the most respected director in the history of the American theater, 21 Tony Awards and counting, the legendary Hal Prince. You're going to talk about, I think, one of the plays in the flop or forgotten category, but important to you in any language?
Oh, well, no, this is a story about me. You have to understand something. I never worked with Uta. I saw almost all the plays that are listed in Wikipedia or whatever it is. I totally... I was in awe of her, and there are just two. I mean, I'm the audience you were talking about. We can talk about all those shows from an audience point of view, but there are just two little anecdotes, and I feel I'm in the wrong place at this table. But in any case, basically, in any language story is I was drafted in 19. The end of in early 1950 to the Korean War, which is another war we lost. You know what I mean? Anyway, I went to Germany. Thank God. I spent 2 years, almost 2 years, 2 years in the army, over a year in Germany, and then I came back and we landed in Hoboken. A troop ship, and I called my parents, which was nice, and then I bought a New York Times, and it said opening tonight in any language, with Uta Hagen and Walter Matthau, directed by George Abbott, and I called my parents back and said I'm going to be late. I had a duffel bag, and I was in uniform, and I went straight to the Court Theater, and the Pops, that was the doorman, of course. The doorman said, "What are you here for? Who do you want?" I said, "I want to see Mr. Abbott." And he said, "Well, do you know him?" And I said, "Yes, I know him. I used to work for him." He said, "Well, he's sitting on the stage in the set." So I made my way to the set, which was a Raoul Pen du Bois elegant Italian living room in a hotel. And I walked out, and Abbott had said to me, 2 years, it's nothing. And I thought, oh, yes, it's nothing in my terms. So he looked up and said, you're back already. And anyway, see, this story is not much about Uta, but in any case, what happened was that I did not go home until after the opening. I said, is there any place I can hide and see the show? And he said, sure, well, you sit with me. And we went in the back of the house. And so I saw the opening night of In Any Language. And then I went home and embraced my beloved parents, who realized once and for all theater was uppermost in my mind. The other anecdote, which really led to our being good friends very late in her life, I'm sorry to say. I went to see Mrs. Klein, and I wrote her the biggest fan letter in the world. I mean, I actually invoked the name Lorette Taylor and said, there are a few performances that have meant that much to me. You really are extraordinary, and so thank you for it. And a few days later, I got a note saying, don't you remember we met when you were 14 years old? I worked for a friend of hers, a fashionista lady. I was a delivery boy in the summer. And one day, I was introduced to her, and she obviously said, what do you want to do? And I said, I guess I want to be a director or something like that. And that's the end of that story, except that all those years later, she said, you don't remember that we met? Of course I remember you. And then that began to be letters exchanged. And then I went to see the two-hander that she played, which I thought was really an interesting play.
Charlotte.
About the writer and the...
Delmore Schwartz.
Right.
Collected stories.
And then I went to the hospital to see her. And she was very feisty mood in those days. That was a lot of fun. And basically, we kept in touch from then on all the time. And the only thing that all that means to a guy like me is that I did see all of those plays. I Key Largo?
Key Largo.
I saw Key Largo.
Othello?
Of course.
Country Girl, St. John.
Please. I saw The Seagull. I don't know what a kid, as young as I was making of all some of the stuff that I was seeing. I was certainly old enough to just relish Othello. But I did see, though, and I saw Anthony Quinn and Uta in Streetcar. And that was interesting because I had seen Streetcar originally, and I thought it was quite wonderful and rather different. All the balances were different. The relationships were different. And so, in an interesting way, it was a little bit a different play, and very effective, and quite extraordinary. She wasn't as fragile. Well, she couldn't be as fragile. I've been listening back there, so I know these
don't do
people.
Fragile.
Don't do fragile. But that was. And then there's just one other thing I wanted to say, and that is. Is it respect for acting?
Respect for acting and then a challenge for the actor.
I always thought that's an absolutely wonderfully realized, wonderfully written book. And I thought she and Agnes DeMille were two artists who worked different disciplines and who possessed the talent to write about them with such depth and appreciation, and that's unique.
That's unique, yes.
It's interesting about respect for acting. Because her other book is called Love of Cooking.
Yes. Yes.
There's a contrast there. I think it had to do with Mama and Papa, because Oscar was very much a theorist of the arts, and Mama was the cooker. Was the cook, but Letty will tell me if I'm wrong about that. But she said once in class, I think this was, she said, I'm so torn between my two vocations, one a cook and the other an actor. She said, I was watching a student of mine do a scene, and she was in her kitchen, and she was doing the things you do in a kitchen, and all I could think, this is what she said, all I could think of is, That's not the way to cut our carrots.
Let me ask our panel, what was the finest Uta Hagen performance that you saw? And then I'll, the next question is, what was the least effective, the finest acting performance you saw on the stage from the point of view of an audience member, not working with her?
Well, I thought the summit of her work was in Mrs. Cline.
So did I.
I thought it was like the fulfillment of everything that she'd been. She took a long time to develop. I mentioned that she despised that whole first part of her career. I had never seen her act when I was in a play with her. She came to Bermuda to try out a new play. And everybody was very much in awe of her. And one person I remember saying, she burns up the stage when she's on the stage. And I remember thinking, nonsense, nobody burns up the stage. What is this? About a week later, I have a charred ember. she truly burns up the stage. She always had that. But I remember out at the University of Chicago having the recording of Othello, which she made with Jose Ferrer and Paul Robeson. She was then at the height of her stylistic excellence, and she came to despise all that. But I still can remember the way she delivered the line. I can still quote it. I do perceive here a divided duty. And I thought, that isn't the Uta that I now know. She wouldn't have done it that way now. But she learned, and she was.
Well, what about Virginia Woolf? You all saw, that's her signature piece. That's what she will be most remembered for.
Yes, I thought that was the best, but I would. I mean, I saw it many, many times. Very close to. Yes.
What distinguished that performance? Was it the intensity of it, the commitment, the rage, the wit, all of the above?
I doubt if it's ever been done better.
Rage.
Because the whole alcoholic thing and that whole sort of show-offy, self-indulgent thing, which is certainly part of the warp and woof of the performance, but what really, really stands out for me was ferocity. Just untrammeled rage.
She was wonderful. When we did it in London, she insisted that we all meet at the five, the call of the 5 minute, on the stage. And a lot of, have you had a nice day? What was your day like? And a lot of huggy feet. And it was amazing. And she said, because I'm not going to have the first thing that I, when I first see you that evening, I'm not going to be singing fuck off at you. I want us all to be kind to each other. And Arthur Hill, who was just, he adored the law more than the theater. But he spent every day at the law courts. So, and what cases did you see today? And all that going on. It was wonderful. And it meant that they didn't, we didn't fall apart. I mean, the minute she had left, and it was, they were the replacements, the man who was playing George and I, finally, very quickly, did not speak. And when it came time for the last party, the farewell party, it had to take place in two rooms. One in Constance Cummings' room, who was playing then, and one in the girls who was playing Honey, because he and I would not be in the same room together. It was bizarre, and one realized that, and that was, I think that is a sort of total story about her, that she was so totally committed to the performance that she was giving, but also to the event itself, and that she protected the event itself, that it was a play, and we were not real, but it was totally, it seemed totally real at the time, and it was totally her.
And I was overhearing as best I could the business about starting it on the stage. There are, that's defining about kinds of acting. Helen Hayes could chat right there in the wing and then just go right on and and be in that moment and in that play. That is something I think was true of Uta. Otherwise, you don't go around saying, oh, darling, oh, and then run out on stage. Because the alternative, of course, is all that quiet time in the dressing room preparing and you know, and it's a method sometimes.
But she didn't have necessary. To do that. But she only prepared the first entry.
She didn't have to do that, and I think...
But she didn't have to do that because she had spent so long building the character.
Yes, well, I think that's
it was based on all that homework. You read the books and you see that she worked so hard on each role before you got to rehearsal. So she could come on like that because it was based on preparation.
She knew where she was. She knew
the character. She knew the given circumstances.
When they did the original production, she and Arthur were sort of in despair. They said, "What is this play about? What is it for?" And all that they were going on. She said, I suddenly one day said to Edward, "Oh, I've got it. I know exactly what that line means." And he cut it. And so she said, "I never did that again, but I certainly learned a big lesson."
But you know, the thing about it is what you all are saying, and which I suddenly, it's so strong in my mind, is that I never met anybody who loved acting the way she did. Loved acting, loved the theater, loved the art of performing, loved the process of performing. It was really, I mean, her cooking was great. But I'm telling you, she loved the theater.
She was a great cook.
She was a great cook. And many times, she would invite me to her Gramercy Park apartment and cook, because she would have other people there. And I considered it the highest honor of my life that I was invited to her apartment to eat her cooking. And if you've ever done the recipes in her book, they are really good. I mean, they work. They work. You have to try them.
But she took that very seriously, too. I remember I once visited her in Montauk, and I drove out, and I arrived for the first time. I came up to the house, and she was at the window upstairs, looking out, seeing me come. And she said, "Oh, good." And she said, "I'll be right there." And she'd prepared the water to boil the pasta, and she wasn't going to put it in until I arrived, but she wasn't going to wait a second afterwards. So it went straight in, and I got in, hello, sit down, and it was served.
I can go better, do one better than
that. Oh, please.
But once when I was on my way, if it was Friday that we were to have dinner with Uta, about Wednesday evening, there was a phone call from Uta saying, "Your dinner is ready." She had been preparing it, all doing all the necessary stuff, so that when you arrived, there it was.
Yes.
They left that.
We've talked about her giving great performances, but she was human after all, and not every characterization was completely realized. So when did you see her when the performance wasn't perfect? We're among friends here. Richard, you said the Cherry Orchard was not quite
well. I never
right.
saw the performance. I was in it.
But you're in.
And she was so unhappy. No, I never saw a bad one. I mean, I saw wrong ones, I guess, but I mean, not bad ones. Never bad, actually.
I saw You Never Can Tell, which was late.
Shaw. Yeah,
and she loved Shaw, of course. But it was very interesting at Circle in the Square. I don't know if anybody saw that, where she talked very quietly, and her performance was at a different pitch from that of any of the other actors, and the audience was uncomfortable because they weren't quite hearing her. It was as if this was her idea of the role, but it wasn't quite full in realization yet, and I wasn't sure, but it's been bothering me all these years because I didn't think it was quite right.
No, it wasn't, and she was very unhappy in that performance. And, she said later on, "There were no big scenes. It was all on one level. And she couldn't explode in the part. And it was not in her nature to sit there and just let the other actors dancing around her, not knowing what was cooking inside her."
But
no, she was not.
She wasn't happy in that.
Not at all.
That was not. Why were there so many years when she didn't work, or she worked only privately at the studio, but she wasn't on Broadway? After Virginia Woolf, she could have done anything. But there were years when she didn't work, and then toward the end of her life, she worked happily quite a bit, which is when I saw her a lot.
Ask any actress when she gets to be about 37, until she gets to be about 57.
She said late in her life, she said, I want to be remembered as an actress and not as a teacher. Of course, the teaching in the books is all we have now, and our memories. But it's an evanescent a profession. But she, in the beginning, she loathed acting. She was extraordinary because she had genius. So a 19-year-old girl with the lunts in the Seagull, she was wonderful in that. But after a while, she lost the love of acting. She said it became a chore to her. She was trying to, just what you said, you're going to repeat. Yes. You're going to try to copy it. She was doing those things. Until I think it was Harold Klerman who made such a huge difference in her life when she did Streetcar Named Desire. And he began to strip away all the things that she had learned. And then the love of acting began. And I think she was...
But all the playwrights of that period suited her suddenly. I mean, it wasn't Shaw and Noel Coward and all that crap she couldn't do. But I mean, suddenly it was Albee and Tennessee and all that. Yeah. I mean, it was perfect for her. Suddenly Miller. I mean,
do you know how she felt about films and why we didn't see her more often in films?
Well, she was blacklisted.
She was blacklisted in the 50s, yes. But then there were...
Also in the 50s, everybody was... I mean, in the 50s and even 60s, we were... There were stage actors, and there were television actors, and there were film actors. And you didn't move. If a film actor suddenly did a play, they obviously were in trouble. Their career was on the skids. They were having to do a play, and vice versa. I mean, there really was a big division. And the profession was tiny. I mean, there were 50 classical actors, maybe, in America, and they were all lived in New York, and we all knew each other.
But if you see her performances in those three films, she doesn't look like she's a visiting stage luminary slumming in the movies. She looks completely at home on
film.
But she
knew exactly what acting was. What acting was, and acting is the same. But, I mean, there are different techniques and so on, but basically...
But you know, students of the future who want to see Uta Hagen will watch The Other or Boys from Brazil or Reversal of Fortune, like it or not. That will be a part of her legacy because those films can be seen. You can check them out of your video store.
Read the books.
She's excellent in them. She's excellent. The technique is absolutely suited for the camera.
But you know, she didn't like it. She didn't like it. She said, I hate waiting around. I hate the slowness of it. I hate not. She just didn't like the process. She said that more than once.
I think acting in film has changed enormously. And in other words, there's a lot of whispering going on now. It's all very cozy, and you don't... It's got a kind of its own crazy reality, but it's not... It's not really acting. I think that really great acting, people projected in front of the camera, not all that differently from the way they project on the stage. And I never took much to movie making, but I did make one movie with Angela Lansbury and a bunch of stage actors. And everybody just projected. I thought that was just grand. I never, you know. And then I made another movie with all movie people, and I'd stand. They didn't have those little, you know, units where you can look at it as a television show and see if that's what you expected. But you just stood behind the cameraman, and I could never hear anything. And I'd always say, did she do it? and then he'd say, well, you'll see it at the rushes. and of course, too late to do it. But so I just loathed it. But acting was very different in the in that somewhat earlier era. People really acted.
This is very tempting because I can come this close and talk like that. And that's a temptation to the young actor because that thing is hanging right over his head.
May I say you've got a voice?
Yeah. I think if we can end with, if each of you would share a personal moment with Uta Hagen off stage, a personal encounter, a private moment, to Ooh. Use actor's jargon.
No.
Well, I do remember Uta and I were at the Vancouver Arts Festival, and we were doing a Zero Do play. Herbert directed. We haven't talked enough about Herbert today because Herbert was the linchpin. We'll do another program about Herbert. But they were together, and they completed each other in a most wonderful way. But there was a moment in the rehearsal of that Giraud du play, and we were playing divorced spouses, and we got lost in the fury of the scene, and for some reason, my hand encountered her breast. And I don't know, to this day, I don't know, it may have been, I may have been reluctant to withdraw the hand, I don't know what it was, but she said, she turned at that moment to Herbert, and her next line was, I love you, and she said, I love you. She said, and ever after, she called me Love of the Boobs, that's what she called me. Love of the Boobs.
That's it. Hal, you were telling us backstage about your encounter with her at the hospital, her behavior.
Well, I just thought that's revealing. The best story to end this in. No, I went up to the hospital, which was in Harlem, and was a Jewish hospital, I think, and it was a small, not a large hospital, and her room was small, very small. And I brought up a bunch of flowers, and I walked into the room, and there were a lot of flowers. And she looked and she said, how nice, and then she turned to the nurse and said, will you do something with these? And that's the last she saw the flowers, or I saw the flowers. But it was the last time I saw her. And she was, it was fun, because she was pissed off, is the only phrase I can say, about just being there and the whole thing, and talking about doing a play, which she'd been announced for, something about waltzes or something, a two-hander, I think. And I had heard from somebody that she didn't think it was a very good play. I myself didn't think it was a very good play for other reasons entirely. I'd read it. I thought it was kind of a terrible play. But I thought, gee, she's certainly a star. And the young man she was playing opposite, she thought was just grand. And he was a very good actor. But why I had to say to her, I hear you're doing that play, with an expression on my face that said it all. And she said, it's a marvelous play. What are you talking about? And so I thought, well, that's it. I'm not going. Finished. Belief. Don't ever say that sort of thing again.
No. Belief. So she believed in it.
I guess.
Feisty until the end. She had great energy and strength. Hasn't it been wonderful talking to Uta's friends and colleagues and co-workers?